All right, so once again, welcome to the SpeechPathology.com e-learning experts seminar. Today's event is Lesson Planning Essentials, Mapping Evidence-Based Practices to Instructional Design. Our instructor today is Angela Sterling Orth. She is the Director of Clinical Education and a Clinical Associate Professor at University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, where she supervises in the clinic and teaches graduate and undergraduate coursework. She specializes in serving individuals who stutter in school-based SLP services and using innovative technologies for instruction and service delivery. And we're always glad to have her here with us. So welcome, Angie. Glad to have you.
Thanks so much, Amy. This is really fun, very exciting to be back with SpeechPathology.com. And I hope I'm being heard. I'm just going to keep on talking and expect someone's going to let me know if things aren't coming through okay. So welcome from Wisconsin. I wore a Wisconsin shirt today, although I'm not in Badgerland right now. I guess I am in Badgerland because I'm in Wisconsin, but in University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, blue gold land. So yes, and I have 18 of my students up above me in a classroom watching. So hi, folks. And I think at least one of our part-time grads, I think I saw Stacy's name in the list. So just a shout out to her. And I try to scan the list. I always think I'm going to see more people I know because I think as an SLP, you think, oh, I just know everyone who's an SLP. But alas, that's not true. There are lots of us. So I'm very excited to be with you folks today. Really excited that there are this many people who are interested in hearing more about my take on lesson planning. And so that's really, really fun. When I was working with Amy last year and showing them the things that I'd been working on, and they grabbed this topic from my list of favorites, and I was really excited with how many people want to be part of that conversation with me. So I will say I see I really look like a geek. I do wear the webcam because SpeechPathology.com assures me that participants like that better. So you can see me. My students have assured me of that too. But our learning and technology services people on campus say we should never do it with headset boom mics on because we look like geeks. But it's better quality that way. And it didn't look so bad until then I put my glasses on top of it. So now I am really geeking out. But nonetheless, excited to head into this topic with all of you today. I will say, you know, my role and experiences, Amy gave a little bit of background about what I'm currently doing. You know, related to this topic, I'm just a geek for all things related to planning. Personally, I make lists, I check things off my lists, I like grids and boxes. I love digging for materials and finding a way to put those into my practice. And I just have a passion for organization. Now that's, you know, my personal sort of life. And as we know, that spills over into our professional practice. But on top of that professionally, I've really worked hard to find a way to teach lesson plan development. I started as a freshman on this very campus thinking I was going to become a teacher. I was going into teacher ed, then kind of shifted to school psych and of course the hybrid of that, speech language pathology. But I knew I wanted to work in a teaching learning context. And you know, my temperament being one of being liking to organize, the whole lesson planning part fit for me. So I really enjoy teaching lesson plan development. I have a real passion for figuring out how to infuse the evidence-based practices into careful planning. I've also had the luxury, the blessing, absolutely, for working with lots of beginning clinicians, lots of undergraduate and graduate students, people out in their first couple of years experiencing challenges with trying to make everything fit. And so I've been able to facilitate those beginning stages for clinicians along the way. And then even on top of that, I go into all of my teaching learning contexts with a pretty detailed written lesson plan. I've just never been able to let go of that. So I bring all of that together as I give you my biases on lesson plan development and implementation here today. So I just want to do a couple of show of hands now that I've introduced, you know, sort of where I come at this from. I just have a couple of questions. So you have your thumbs up and thumbs down buttons on your screen. So if you have access to those, I just would like to see a show of hands. Let's say for those of you who are primarily working with children in your service delivery. So click on that green thumbs up if you're primarily someone who works with children. Okay, all right. And I know I'm going to force your hand in one of these categories because you know what my next question is going to be, is how about those of you who, okay. Now a thumbs up if you primarily work with adults. And if you're pretty split, I'm going to know you're that leftover group. So show of hands with a thumbs up if you primarily work with adults. Okay. Okay, so it's about just over half of you primarily work with children, and then there just a half a dozen primarily adults. So there's lots of you out there, almost half of you, that are doing a little bit of everything. And isn't that the beauty? I tell our students that all the time. You get to do whatever you want when you're done across the lifespan. So that's really exciting. Okay, so another show of hands. Want to see how many of you, and this isn't throwing yourselves under the bus at all, because you're going to find out pretty quick. My soapbox is not to suggest you should all of a sudden start writing detailed written lesson plans. It's not that at all. So how many of you are required to write and submit written lesson plans as you work as a speech language pathologist? Okay. The numbers are climbing, and the numbers that are climbing are the ones that say, no, you're not required to. So, okay, so just a handful of you are required to write written lesson plans and submit them. I know that the few years that I spent in the public schools, I was required to write and submit written lesson plans. I'm not sure anyone read them or cared so much what they said. I learned that sort of quick too, but I was required to submit them. That question asked whether you were required to. So let's clear the slate on that. And how many of you write some semblance of a lesson plan for most of the sessions that you conduct? Some degree of a lesson plan for the majority of the sessions that you conduct. Okay. So it's about a half of you that are saying that some written form, outline or bulleted list or more formal plan is something you're choosing to write for most of the lessons that you conduct. Okay, so last question I'm going to ask you before I move into the meat of my content is related to whether you're someone who's in a role of supervising others. So others who might be writing or needing lesson plans under your supervision. So if you're in a role, a leadership role, a supervisory role, where someone you're supervising either needs to be writing lesson plans or needs you to write them for them, or, okay, so just a few. Okay, all right, so that just gives me a better sense of where you're all coming at on this topic. Okay. So let's move on to the next slide. So I have the outcomes that I'm required to read to you verbatim. As much as I don't like reading slides verbatim, I will comply, because I'm a compliance type person. So my first learner outcome is to explain the evidence-based practices associated with the stylistic components of lesson planning and implementation. The next one is that you will describe how to utilize self-selected lesson planning formats to ensure inclusion of supported instructional design and service delivery. And my third is that you will describe how to model the lesson planning essentials and process for supervisees and mentees. And so I hope to do that and even more today as we move through this 90 minutes together. All right, so my agenda, I'll try not to spend too much time on this because you can look at this for yourself, and if you're like me, check things off as we go. My little lesson plan, see, I told you I don't go into anything without a lesson plan. So here's my lesson plan for today, just a little bit of information about one of my favorite topics in our field, the art versus the science of speech-language pathology, a little bit of background information, we'll follow that, a brief overview of a handful of lesson planning models that I've uncovered for you, some of which you've heard of before and some that might be new to you. And then I'm going to talk about how do we infuse evidence into those components of a lesson plan, because we know that evidence-based practice is really what we need to be demonstrating as we do our service delivery, looking at some lesson planning formats, some questions about lesson plan formats, what matters, what doesn't, mental maps versus written, and then some application of all of those concepts into some real world speech and language caseload demands. So I'll hope to, through some scripted moments, help you see things in action. So that's where we'll travel through today. As I mentioned, one of my favorite things about our field, we are blessed. I know our work worlds get very demanding at times, and the challenges sometimes can outweigh the benefits some days, but we still are very blessed in that we have this profession that's this art and science sort of hybrid. So I wanted to bring that, to call that to mind when I talk about the value of lesson planning. So, you know, in our field, where does science fit in with our lesson planning? Where does art fit in? Certainly, it's much more visible. It's sort of the face of what we're doing, that scientific piece, the techniques that our lesson plan can illustrate that we're using. The way we've scaffolded very strategically and systematically teaching or elicitation of the targets. The way we're, if our lesson plan is detailed, more detailed than mine are actually, in how we're applying those contingencies and giving that feedback and shaping performance and behavior. And then of course, where our data collection is housed. And so, whether it's the science or we're going to look at the art too, but all of this combined, our lesson plans can really be this transmission device for this science part of our profession. I think of lesson plans really as being this vector. I've been looking more at gene therapy recently for something completely different, but, you know, understanding that gene therapy, you know, has this piece of science that is the fix, but it really needs a vector. It needs that transmission device. Otherwise, it's not good for anything. And so I think about lesson planning as well as service delivery models. And we're not going to talk about service delivery models today. There's lots of information out there on service delivery models and less out there on lesson plan development. But those two parts of what we do, those two methods of what we do combined, really can be the vector for these tried and true or up and coming innovative evidence-based practices, the science of what we're doing to make a difference in the communication and swallowing across the lifespan. And so we definitely can see at face value how science and our lesson plans can fit together, but also the artistic piece. And that's the part I'm hoping to inform or reassure you about today, maybe emphasize for you. Lesson plans can really illustrate the creative demands of our profession as well, okay? And in these ways and others for sure. You know, showing our style, you know, is your lesson plan filled with media or music and movement? So some of those things that aren't necessarily dictated by or warned against related to evidence-based practices, but we're infusing it because it's stylistic in nature. Lesson plans can certainly guide our timing depending on how detailed that they are. I try my best on all of my lesson plans before I head into the classroom to put how many minutes in parentheses after the item on my lesson plan, and I fail miserably oftentimes at meeting that. desire that I've mapped out, but they hold the potential to guide our timing. And I talked about, you know, a placeholder for those materials that can really show our style, and our lesson plans, and hopefully something additional I'll be able to illustrate for you today can really make a space for the rapport building maintenance alliances we forge with clients. And that's huge. And I'm hoping to share with you the research that will support valuing this part. So, you know, the question that you might ask as you see a slide like this and is, you know, is this part essential? Does it matter? Does it have value? And I'm hoping to share with you the research today that will enforce that, yes, indeed, this artistic piece of what we do definitely has value. You know, and oh, there's a little bit of a glitch there in the format. We had an E fall away. We can all know what that is supposed to represent. So some of us went into this field because we were more relationship building, artistic, creative in nature. We fell more over on this side of the Venn diagram, and others went into speech language pathologists because of the speech and hearing science part. Maybe you loved the audiology class, or you really liked doing oral mech exams, something like that. But in reality, we know that the careful blend of the art and the science is really what it means to be a speech language pathologist. As I've said, we are blessed to have this profession as a way to express ourselves professionally, this role to express ourselves professionally. And we all know, we've all had those days where we fall maybe heavier on one side versus the other, and maybe for very important purposes, and it was necessary that that's the way it worked that day. But if that happens too often, it may start to lead us down a road of not feeling quite right, of a bit out of sorts with the way we're supposed to be practicing. So, you know, I think as I've been and have observed and worked side by side with SLPs for over two decades now, I've seen that, you know, people are usually shooting for this nice mix of our art and our science. And I'm going to illustrate for you today, hopefully reassure you again, remind you, show you some new things about how you can make sure that's happening. All right, so that was background information, but a little bit more background information before I get into the nitty-gritty of some specifics related to lesson planning. Again, I mentioned it, you know, being the framework for the services that we're going to be delivering. Again, that vector that we talked about, we can have all of the knowledge in the world about how to remediate an R or trigger some executive functions or help a person learn how to do pullouts to be more fluent. But if we don't have that delivery device, then it doesn't matter what we know about treatment. Lesson plans, you know, classically are related to treatment and instructional work rather than assessment. We know that. I think more of us probably put a plan together when we move into an assessment, because we're investing this, you know, 45, 60, 90 minutes, 2 hours sometimes into this extensive activity. And so we're maybe more likely to put a written plan into place. But what I'll primarily be referencing today is related to treatment or instructional activities. We do know that historically, lesson planning really comes from our education colleagues, the education world, ed psych, teacher ed in particular, those folks who really have invested their professional careers in studying and working with learning, how people learn, how people generalize their learning. And it's those folks that I've borrowed from most to help us see the importance of this concept in delivering speech language pathology services. You know, and lesson plans really, and I'm going to really lay the groundwork for describing why I think it's maybe more important now than ever to have this conversation, is that face value component. Our stakeholders are demanding more and more from us and from other professions too. We're not novel in this situation related to our service delivery. More make more progress, work with more people, show us that the services you're providing have more value than something else, or in addition to something else, or instead of something else. So, and those, I'm going to refer to those folks as our stakeholders as I talk with you this afternoon. And they can be so many different people. It could be the parents of the toddler we're going into their home on a weekly basis. It could be the colleague we're trying to get on board with some co-teaching at the elementary building or middle school or high school. It could be the administrator who's coming in to decide whether we need one full-time SLP or should cut back to 0.8. It could be a director of special education or rehab who is determining balances of workload, caseload, et cetera. So actually the stakeholders, even more importantly for so many of us, are the clients themselves. And, you know, little ones, we could describe how we would put them into the category of stakeholders. I tend to put their parents in that category more. But school age on up through adulthood, older adults, they are definitely the most important stakeholders. So the face value that what we're delivering has for them is something I think that can be heightened through our lesson planning. And we all know, I think it doesn't come as a surprise to anyone, not even my students, that lesson planning is an unregulated component of what we do. There are many of those things. I always say it's another one of the blessings of being a speech-language pathologist is that we have a high degree of autonomy. That doesn't mean that's true for all of you. I know that things are getting tighter and more prescriptive in different places. But generally speaking, we have a fair amount of autonomy related to scheduling, service delivery models, and absolutely related to lesson planning and implementation. And so that shouldn't, we have to be careful to make sure that people don't end up having regrets about that, but using it to our advantage to make sure we can make those smart choices related to our lesson planning and implementation that elevate our practices. We do know that while it's unregulated, it still is, as our show of hands showed us, at least a couple dozen of you are required to submit written lesson plans. And that, you know, we're not talking about just a specific format, and stressing to you again, I'm going to try to stress this to you a few times today. I'm not talking always about a rigid, written, customized lesson plan, so many different formats that are available. I'm not talking about cookbooks either. And not that I'm always opposed to a prescriptive plan. I think there's some teaching and learning that where that holds merit, and hopefully I'll highlight that for you today. But I think of it more related to more something a little less specific than a cookbook, and I'll talk about that as I continue along here. One of my favorite things about lesson planning and being able to work with undergraduate and graduate clinicians in the beginning stages of learning how to practice professionally is how it can really elevate our clinical problem solving. Talking with someone about how our principles are different from our practices and how our practices are different from our materials. So really fleshing out those concepts. And whenever, you know, I'm working with beginning clinicians, we stress how clinical writing and lesson plan is a form of clinical writing, can always elevate our practice and solidify concepts for us. I can sit in my office with a supervisee and talk about, yep, you should do this and that, and then do this and that, and okay, go have a great session. Or they can say to me, I'm going to do this and that, and then this and that, and my session's going to be great. And then they might walk away, and without a written lesson plan, might walk into the therapy moment, and it might sort of fall apart, you know, right from the start. Leaving my office and then going back and writing that down and reflecting on it can really heighten that clinical problem solving. And that's just not just true for you know, my poor undergrad clinician. It's true for all of us. I can sit down with a very challenging case or a new topic in a class I'm teaching and need to map it out first before I ever teach it for the first time in written form for me to fully understand the subcomponents and then the tools and media and resources that I'm going to use to teach and then practice and all of that. So it really does beautiful things to clinical problem solving. And that works to then create that proactive approach to service delivery. And I really stress, again, not the cookbook approach, but simply these placeholders for quality service delivery. And I don't know if anyone remembers, because I want to compare sort of a cookbook that you put this in and then this in and then this in to something like the Richard Simmons Deal a Meal. Now, I know my students aren't going to know this, but unless it's still something today, but back when I was in my 20s, it was the nutrition plan where you had all these slots, but you got to choose what went in the slots that day. And that's probably a lot of like how Weight Watchers or something works today. So it's not the cookbook that says, here's your menu for the day. You have to eat this much of this and allowing no flexibility, but something like Deal a Meal where you have all of these options available and then you have the placeholders and you're going to slot those into place. That's what I think of as lesson plans, really are placeholders. And being careful not to confuse the proactive with rigid, the difference. Let me start over again. Not to confuse the proactiveness that lesson plans require with being too rigid. Okay, just because you're proactive and been thoughtful and sketched out a plan, again, either a mental map or a written plan, doesn't mean that your lesson needs to be delivered in a rigid fashion. Okay, reactive would be sort of a fly by the seat of your pants approach and might look very flexible, but you have to be very experienced, very talented to pull off a reactive type approach and deliver quality services. Okay, and for most of us, we need a proactive approach. We need to go into the therapeutic moment intentionally with a plan so that through that high level of proactiveness, we actually can be flexible. So I would argue the more proactive we are with our thoughtful planning and clinical problem solving, the greater the likelihood that we're going to be able to be flexible during the implementation of the plan. So that's sort of my bias, and hopefully I'll be able to continue to convince you of that today as we move along. Again, more background information. I know that the background information is probably not background, it's probably the meat of what I'm trying to set up for you. And then we'll move into some lesson planning models to move all this into place. Again, valuing that stakeholder, but really valuing the customer. And I think about a decade or so back when, because I'm not going to throw speech language pathology under the bus, I'm going to throw PT under the bus for a second. And physical therapy is a wonderful thing, and I've gotten great benefit from it since this time. But my first ventures into physical therapy for a sciatic nerve did not go so well. And so I worked with physical therapists quite extensively when I practiced clinically, some co-treat and at least some multidisciplinary teamwork, valued it greatly, still do. But when I had to become the patient and I went for my first appointment for physical therapy, I sat in kind of a shoddy waiting room and then got whisked back into a real kind of dingy treatment room. And the PT was pretty rushed, running a little bit behind schedule, and kind of whipped me up on the table and didn't really mediate at all. There were no pleasantries. And she wasn't rude at all, but it was just very matter of fact. Did some range of motion things, tossed a couple of handouts at me, had me sort of demonstrate some of the exercises to do at home. Took me through some nice practice with those exercises. I could tell that what they were supposed to do would have some benefit. At least they was making me feel good in that moment. And then she essentially, you know, told me to schedule for a week from that day to come back in and see her again. And needless to say, I abandoned my physical therapy after that day, at least for another 6-9 months. And then I switched to a different company, and then I got actually almost complete relief from my sciatica. The value that was placed on me that day, again, she wasn't rude. She wasn't ugly with me, harsh or terse at all, just kind of distant, and didn't have really any polish on her practice. And for me, the face value of what was being delivered was non-existent. That physical therapist, I actually could get a glimmer of the fact she knew what she was doing. She knew that, and actually the protocol that was set up for me when I went to a different physical therapist later that year was the same. Her evidence-based practices for alleviating that sciatica through home practice and then just touching base on a weekly basis for a month or so was exactly what needed to happen to fix my physical limitation. No question about it. But there was no polish or delivery mechanism on those evidence-based practices that allowed me to continue, that encouraged or allowed me to continue to access those services. And I'm a pretty cognitive customer and value my health. And even that didn't keep me forging ahead into that therapeutic relationship. And it wasn't that I didn't want to go back there and see her again. I probably could ask for a different PT there. But it just was enough that as I left there that day, I thought, no, you know what? My sciatica is fine. I'm just going to set that aside for now. And I disconnected from services instantly. And so really, we want to use lesson planning in whatever way we do it to make sure that that doesn't happen, okay? To make sure we can deliver the services that we intend to, need to, want to deliver. And then finally, sort of the last two are kind of my biggies. Hopefully the things I've set the groundwork for already have been convincing enough. But what's new and different right now is related to our changing role and how much more critical it is now than it was even just a few years ago. But for sure, when I was learning how to be a speech language pathologist, these things weren't really a thing. So sort of the call to have us do more inclusionary services, I'm oftentimes being asked by students in terms of how can I get into the classroom? How can I be collaborative with teachers? How can I team teach, whether with general or special ed or with PT or OT or whoever it is that we're collaborating with? Inclusionary services are something that we're called to task on now more than ever. And when we're in those classroom-based settings, a more formal official lesson plan is really critical. Our colleagues, and I'll just talk specifically about public schools right now, are not necessarily going to want to team with us if we can't be thoughtful and intentional and scripted with our planning, at least to some degree. And so that's just a role that we need to be able to embrace more and more, and lesson planning might be able to help us do that. Group services, so not just the classroom base, but we're subjecting ourselves, and I say that with humor, in a good way, we're subjecting ourselves to more and more innovative group service delivery models. And so whether it's running a community aphasia group or leading a social skills group, running a preschool phonology group, we have all sorts of ways that we can, across the lifespan, utilize a group format. And all of us know that, you know, we bring that one or the two maybe clients, patients, students in with us, nose to nose. And, you know, we don't get discombobulated too easily. We can deliver pretty solid services with just our mental map, just our mental plan. As soon as that starts to be 3, 4, 5, 7, maybe showing up for 90 minutes once a week for group, that's not necessarily the case. We need something a little bit more articulated, a little bit more thoughtful, so that we can balance those things that I shared with you earlier related to the art and the science, the timing, the stylistic pieces, the behaviors of everyone involved, the participation, the
all of the key elements of instruction and practice. And so group services really make that more demanding and really call us to think more formally about our lesson planning. And this is just another slight spin on that, but meetings and in-services. So more and more we're getting called to do in-services to colleagues, to related professionals, to parent caregiver training. And we don't want to go into those moments not carefully planned. And so I would argue lesson plans work are important in those situations. And another one I don't have on the list is related to working as a supervisor. So more and more of us have supervisees. Now, whether that's paraprofessionals, officially speech language pathology assistants, or special ed paraprofessionals in general, or maybe it's clinical fellows, maybe it's practicum students. Hopefully it's practicum students. If you're saying yes, when people like me call you and email you and say, please take our students, hopefully you're in that role from time to time. But any of those supervisory roles really require either you to be writing the lesson plans for the delivery of the services, if not inspecting them or guiding others to create them. And so that could be a fourth item on our list there of how our role has been evolving and demanding greater use of lesson planning. And the last one is simply a bias of mine, and that a written tool, in particular a written tool, we can't do this as well with our mental maps for our lesson plans. Encourage you as we wrap this up today to think about at least occasional written plans so that we can reflect on our service delivery and do some professional development just within ourselves related to the services that we're delivering. So that's my background information. Now I'm going to move into, and this looks extensive, but really what I just did and then what I'm going to do after I whisk you through these six lesson plan models is really more the meat of what I want to share with you today. But I didn't want to talk about lesson plans and lesson plan development without at least paying some respect to official models that are out there, because we don't need to reinvent the wheel. There are lots of models that exist out there already, many more than what I've highlighted here. I don't want you to think there's any prescriptive or forced choice amongst any of these or others, because that's not what it's about. More than anything, I chose these six to cover a range of the different models that are out there. And I know this will happen for you, that within seeing a quick spin through each of these six, that you'll see yourself in one or more of them. You'll see your practice in one or more of them because you're already doing these things. Maybe one of these models is more closely associated with the way you practice than another or the others. And maybe you're just sort of doing something from each of these different models. But you will see yourself in your practice as we go along. And then, of course, what I'm hoping it also does is give you some information to help make some adjustments and additions, tweaks to what you're doing in your practice. And now that you'll have something to hang your hooks on that you didn't know about before. Okay, so these six, there's nothing necessarily magical about them, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time in hopes that you're going to learn and stay wedded to these six models, but they all have something to offer. Okay, and the first one is Madeline Hunter's model. It might be the one most of you are familiar with. It is definitely one that I learned as an undergraduate. When I was learning how to be a speech-language pathologist, and in particular in my school methods course, which is my class that's listening above us right now. So Madeline Hunter's model has these basic components. I don't want to call them steps, but components. And so I'll let you eyeball that list. I'm not going to necessarily read. Some of these models have extensive levels to them or components to them. So you can see that Hunter's model has instruction and practice built in, and also bookends that with some setup and some closure. So that's sort of the gist of her model. Okay. Madeline Hunter was from the ed psych world. One sort of criticism of her model was that it was too graduated, too stepped. And actually, that's not really what she intended by it at all. So I took the numbers off and just put those check boxes. It's supposed to be more fluid than that, but it is very detailed. When you see lesson plans developed using Hunter's model, they are very scripted, actually, even though the model in and of itself doesn't look like it would call for scripted moments. Examples that you would find online end up looking quite scripted. And of course, that does create that potential for it to be too rigid or inflexible. Okay, so criticism that Hunter's model has taken, if any, over the years is that it might be too cookbooky. Okay, so that is some miscellaneous about her model. But what application might it have for a speech language pathologist? Certainly, you can look at that model and see that when starting off working with a particular type of client or new, you know, for a beginning clinician, this model could hold great potential. I mean, wouldn't it be a fantastic thing as something is unfamiliar or new to you still being able to tear a sheet from a lesson plan book and being able to deliver it just as is would be quite appealing if that only was possible. But glimmers of that can be possible. So think about those people delivering services we might be overseeing, and a model like this might be something to consider. Certainly this model and others will have high applicability when we're talking about a protocol that has to be very tightly designed for research purposes, where we don't want there to be flexibility or wiggle room. Okay, unless it's critical, we might need a model like this. And then, of course, you can also see that something more scripted, more rigid, might be a better match when we're dealing with some extenuating behavioral demands, if we need to keep things a little bit tighter to minimize the obstacles to learning. Okay, so Hunter's model, as are a couple of the others I'm going to show you that were spin-offs of it, allow us the opportunity to do these things because of the level of specificity. Okay, so we'll talk about that later as well. Another one that I wanted to highlight is Merrill's first principles of instruction. You can see we've moved from Hunter's, you know, seven elements to now just four here. So Merrill talks about how we sort of have this target, this objective that we need to accomplish. And we're going to activate the learning. We're going to show it in action. We're going to get it applied, and then we're going to get it integrated. So some magic happens through those steps. And we know we can all picture what magic that has to be. It certainly has to be a skillful clinician working through all of those elements. The thing I liked about Merrill's model that is sort of an addition to or something different from what Hunter shared with us is the integration piece. I think we can find these other three elements, activation, demonstration, and application, in what Hunter shared with us for a model. But the integration piece, I think, is something that as speech language pathologists, we always have our mind's eye on. And so I like that Merrill brought that concept in. So that does allow us to focus a little bit more on generalization. And that's not something that Hunter spent a lot of time talking about, although we're certain that she was interested in it, but it wasn't part of the elements of the lesson plan. And Merrill's actually has a little bit more flexibility, so to engage the learner a little bit more actively through a less scripted approach. Okay. So application from the SLP, certainly you can see with just four elements, it might be more applicable to someone who's been practicing longer and they know how to fill in those gaps along the way. And absolutely when we're working on skills that require more of an incidental approach, a sort of an authentic context, we can't necessarily have as tightly wound of a design as Hunter's model might set up for us. We have to have more flow between activities, more back and forth that's a little bit more seamless between instruction and practice, etc. And so something with fewer elements built in, but with still some clear designations to consider with your planning, like Merrill's model, might be something to think about. Merrill's model might not be as applicable with our youngest children because of sort of the cognitive component of isolating that objective and working towards integration, but with older children and adults. And so just as we're talking about it being more applicable with older individuals, that also suggests our more cognitive skills, so our higher levels of cognition and social skills, those things that need some mediated learning, certainly might be a better match for Merrill's model if we were to compare it to something like Hunter's. And we're going to see some other variations of these as we go along too. Again, I'm hoping for you to see yourself in one or more of these models so that you can assure yourself, remind yourself that you're doing some of these things in different ways. So the WIPIA model, this acronym here for, I will talk to you about these steps individually, is the warm-up, the introduction, the presentation, practice, the summative evaluation, and then the application. What's special about this is that evaluation component built in, always sort of that checking for understanding, that feedback loop that's built in, whether it's present for people using Merrill's model or Hunter's model, it's not as clearly articulated. So again, that face value component is underrated sometimes. And so we see here that as a mindful practitioner, that we would have our attention at least partly guided towards checking for acquisition and generalization of skill through those evaluation methods. And that's something that can be pretty important depending on who we're working with and what we're working on. So it really is this continuous teaching cycle. Wiggins and McTeague actually took Hunter's model and decided to make it more fluid and kind of put it in that circular graphical fashion and fleshed out the elements with slightly different terminology. So it really isn't something completely different. So how might we apply a model like that? Essentially, if we're really going to be with individuals in an individual or a group of individuals for more of an ongoing relationship, an extensive curriculum, definitely if we're co-teaching with others. And so it's a model that we really want to have some ongoing nature of our service delivery with that group or individual so that we can keep that feedback loop going and keep adjusting our practice with them as we go. So that's where it might be most applicable. And Gagné's events of instruction. This is really another sort of spin on Hunter's model, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, except to say it really started to bring some more attention to the whole retention and transfer. And I'm a big proponent for this whole transfer. I don't like our service delivery that's sort of done in a contrived, isolated, I feel like most speech language pathologists can get most anyone to do most any communication task as long as it's within their sort of zone of proximal development, but it's the generalization, the application into the real world, that transfer that is so critical and that we really should be focused on at all times. That's important. So I like that one actually had that element fleshed out. But otherwise, it's very similar to Hunter's model, just with some slightly different lingo. It is definitely from that world of educational psychology and is a variation of Madeline Hunter's model as well. So very similar application here for the newer clinician, the beginning clinician or paraprofessional, for someone if we're working with something particularly new or challenging for us, something a little bit more scripted and detailed, is something that any of us could call into action as needed, and that would apply to this model for sure. If I have a bias, it's towards this model, Bybee's model of the five E's of constructivism. I'm sort of a constructivist in nature. In terms of my professional SLP practice, this is really the model that I feel like I'm trying to emulate or put into action. And again, it depends on the age of the person I'm working with and the particular targets we're working on, but it is possibly the one I can relate to best. And the one that I use most for my classroom instruction with university students is the one I'll show you after this one, the last model I'll show you. But the five E's of constructivism here, the hook part of it, which is the engage part, the discovery is what happens through exploration. Let me get my little handy dandy tool out. So we have the hook, the discovery, the explanation, which is really where we can mediate this learning. I'm a big fan of mediated learning. And the elaboration, really how we expand, how we really maximize the production practice in the generalization variables, and then the evaluation, which is really that feedback loop, that check for understanding, et cetera. So those are the things that, you know, when I work to put together a speech and language lesson plan with, school-aged children on up, it's the model that I'm looking at. And partly, I learned Piaget. That's what I learned when I was an undergrad, that's how we learn. That's how we learn speech, language, social interactions. So it's very Piagetian in nature. I'm a big fan of making those associations, those connecting those dots, building those relationships, not just the relationship clinician-client, but relationships between the concepts, making those assimilations, et cetera. Outside of the speech and language world, this model has been used extensively with the teaching of science in elementary through higher ed. So there's some research behind that. And it is the National Reading Council, actually. What the National Reading Council did in 1999 is really synthesize decades of research related to how people learn. And so what they put out in their report was extensive, and I won't do it justice here, but the five E's of constructivism is a lesson planning model that they suggest really holds up in the research as being a great match for teaching, and this is related to K-12 teaching. So it is a model that does get researched. We don't see a lot of research specific to lesson plan models, but some is out there, and so I'll highlight specific research related to specific lesson plan components, but taking an entire model and implementing it to look at the research behind it is not what I will be sharing with you, but we're going to look at specific components of lesson plan models instead. For the five E's of constructivism in the SLP application, I said, all of those naturally occurring speech language communication moments with younger children on up through older individuals for sure. Any learning that we want to make hands-on and interactive. I would argue that this sort of lesson planning mental map is likely what's put into place with all sorts of experienced clinicians, whether they realize they're doing it or not. And I can say that because I've gotten to watch dozens and dozens of experienced clinicians in action as I go out into the field and solicit sites and work with liaison supervision with our university students. So as I get to sneak a peek at the veteran clinician in action, whether they have a plan in front of them or not, if I had to suggest a model I see them just using naturally, it would be this one. And it's likely our biases as we learned about how people acquire speech, language, and communication skills. It's something that we've adopted somewhat naturally. And just another little aside that any of these models will allow room for our universal design for learning principles. But this one, because of sort of the naturalness of the design, definitely is one of those we can highlight. that will help us do that. And then the last one, I promise, the last model I'm going to throw at you is Fink's taxonomy of significant learning. So this is the one for us here at UW-Eau Claire that we've learned to use to elevate our teaching of university students to higher levels. And so it's, I thought I'd be remiss if I didn't mention it here and show that it's something that has great merit. It's very detailed. There are lots of placeholders that we fill as we construct our lesson plans for our university classrooms. And some of them should look very familiar because stating the objective, sort of connecting to prior knowledge, setting up teaching and practice and giving feedback, all of those that we see here really can be found in the models I've sort of highlighted for you up until this point. But the timing and records and reflection here, that's something that is a little bit more unique to this model that Fink has sort of helped guide us to understand the importance of. And so that makes that a little bit different. The timing is that thing that I just keep working on, and I'm working on it here again today too. So it can be a really challenging piece. So as I said, with adult learners, Fink's model can be really a nice match. It is a flexible model. It looks sort of rigid, but it definitely is not a go in this numerical order sort of model. It can carry over many class periods, over big concepts. It has, using it makes you proactive, which, as I mentioned before, increases your flexibility, okay, and really stresses more than anything, and I hope all of these models stress to you is the being intentional with your planning, really mapping things out ahead of time. So I talked about how it's used in speech, how it's used in university teaching, academic and clinical coursework, but SLPs working across the lifespan can be infusing a model like this in ways that I've described some of those other models let us do, and in particular using a model like this in terms of the just the sheer number of placeholders you're filling in can really allow you to give yourself more feedback and really be more reflective related to your practice. Okay, so which model to choose? And the good news is you don't need to make a choice because you have all of these demands on you. And so these different demands will fall into place in different ways at different times, so that you just need to have the flexibility to be able to choose different models at different times. And more than anything else, customize a model that is most fitting to your setting, to the demands of your caseload, not to lose sight of what your style brings to it as well, in addition to your philosophical premises, the evidence-based practices that you hold to be paramount, what your administrator's expectations are on your lesson planning, and then your role. You know, are you writing lesson plans for a paraprofessional to deliver or to model something for a student clinician you're hosting? You might need to use a different format versus those sessions that you're going into that you could do with your eyes closed practically will lead you towards a different model. Okay, so again, more than anything, I would suggest a model or very, you know, models at different times that allow you just to be intentional with your planning, insert your evidence-based practices, and just really be a reflective professional. So I've taken all those models, and years ago, as I started to explore lesson plan models, really just decided, you know, it's too overwhelming. We have all of those models that are out there. There are many more models out there. Some of them have so many steps. What are the most important aspects? And for me, it's these four. Some sort of introduction, some level of instruction or teaching, some level or evidence of practice from the client, and then some type of closure. Those are the most important key components, and just different shades of each of those. And so what I've done is I've taken this general format and mapped what research has shown us about each of them, because I could find you some colleagues, and maybe some of you are those folks who would say, oh, you know what, the introduction is just fluff and stuff. My sessions are too short right now. I only get the kids for 20 minutes. They're going to come in my room, and we're just going to start practice, 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 practice. That's all I have time for. And maybe there's another argument we could make about eliminating one of these other components, but I hope to help you see the importance of all of these components and highlight that with some research for each one as well. Keeping in mind, my general plan I'm sharing with you is not linear. You should be moving fluidly, especially between instruction and practice. I would argue you can use a format like this across the whole lifespan, across all targets and domains, across all stakeholders, etc. And it will allow you, again, to be very proactive, which allows you to increase your flexibility. So I'm going to look at introduction first. Now, for me, the introduction holds potentially four key opportunities, okay? Something like a greeting. So I have some scripts here. Hey, good morning, Mr. Rogers. Boy, this rain sure won't stop, huh? How's it going for you today? Or with kiddos, maybe, hey, guys, you sure seem excited coming in from recess today. What's the best thing you did outside after lunch? Okay, so some type of greeting, some type of review potentially, something like, let's see if you can show me how we practiced that chin tuck last time I was with you, or who can tell me one of the ways we practiced starting a story last time. Okay, so these are two of the four things that an introduction can do for us. The other two are on the next slide. And as I share these, I'm not suggesting all four are critical. Okay, but these are things that introduction can hold for us. A prep set, so something like, let's look at your plan of care and we can decide together what we should spend our time working on today. Or something like, all right, today we're going to listen for and practice lots of words that start with a k sound. Okay, so you can see sort of the lifespan reflected there in those two different options. And the last one is a warm-up. So something like repeat after me and then doing some calisthenics or getting the wiggles out. So let's get our wiggles out and do a fun finger play before we start. So something that warms up the mind or warms up the body or calms down the body, triggers the listening, etc. Okay, so these four things, we've got greeting, review, prep set, and warm-up, all can be part of an introduction. Some of you might be thinking, oh man, if I did all four of those things, that would be 15 minutes and I only have a 20-minute session. What's the, something's got to give. So are they valued? Are they critical? Do you use them? Do you need to set them aside when you're pressed for time? I would argue that they're critical. Some degree shade of one or more of those is critical. And we do have efficacy research related to that. Now, not necessarily in speech and language, but these people who know how people learn are showing us that these things are really important. So those things, greeting, review, prep set, and warm up can all work together in different ways to do one of these four things. One is potentially rapport building and maintenance. And what Patterson discovered through a meta-analysis of lots of research is that with an increased rapport, so he studied warmth and genuineness between the teacher and learner or the clinician and client, and that with increased rapport became increased clinical outcomes. Okay, so we can't underestimate the power of that part of our session. As well as self-efficacy. So identifying those objectives, so that prep set part, what Shunk discovered is that through a research study related to learners' academic motivation, is that the increased level of understanding of how important it is to be working on what they're working on, to be able to do what they're learning how to do, that increased their achievement. Okay, so just the fact that they knew the goals and were part of that goal setting increased achievement. Okay, and that's been held up in the research. The other two research-based components here related to what we might see happening in the introduction are just a heightening of the therapeutic alliance. There's quite a bit of research out there related to therapeutic alliances. The Eaton group and the Joe group both, they really looked at the strength of that therapeutic alliance between the clinician and the client or the teacher and the learner gets established early on. and that an increased strength to that therapeutic alliance consistently results in greater outcomes in the treatment. So the Joe research was related to drug abuse counseling, and the Eaton research was related to psychological sessions. And so we know that we need to invest parts of that introduction to each session, especially early on in that relationship, because what we do then in instruction and production practice can only be heightened if those things are strong. And the other one is related to the attention, engagement, and commitment to the teaching and learning that's ahead. So that prep set and the warm-up. Both Bybee and Merrill, they are collections of research, educational research, so how learners learn. And really what their research is showing, both these groups have said that what the research is showing is that activating prior knowledge and priming the learner to learn consistently increases learner outcomes. Okay, so bottom line, this sort of fluff and stuff that might be something that people have dismissed from time to time, especially when they're crunched for time, holds high potential to impact treatment outcomes consistently. Okay, and so we don't want to set it aside. Okay, so that's the introduction. Instruction, we all know this, okay? I've highlighted four ways instruction can look, but this is the content in part. This is how we teach, okay? And we can divide this up in different ways. We can have direct instruction, okay? So do this, this is how we do this. We can have modeling, so we can do indirect or direct modeling. We know these things are powerful teaching tools. Speech language pathologists, we can have bombardment, so we just wash them in the target, and we can have a more counseling-based instructional report. So that's where we do the talk therapy. And so those four things, direct instruction, modeling, bombardment, and counseling, in a nutshell, I would argue those are four basic different ways speech language pathologists get the content in to the clients that we serve across the lifespan. You can see there's a place for any of those ages and disorder categories, targets that we're working on, et cetera. And we know that when we do those things, that people can acquire skills, okay? So that what instruction in our session can accomplish is sort of a no-brainer. So we know that it can accomplish an increased understanding of whatever that target was. And so here, the Roshine research looked at using explicit direct instruction to increase the knowledge and skills of the learners, and it made a difference. So if we directly instruct, they learn what we're teaching them. Hart and Risley, we know all what we've learned from Hart and Risley over the years is when they were doing their intense research is that the bombarding of the children in the speech language communication context allows them to acquire those speech language communication skills. So that washing in the target. Swanson did a meta-analysis of research looking at direct instruction working with kids with learning disabilities. And so setting up real detailed direct instruction and strategy-based instruction, comparing DI to strategy-based instruction. And essentially what they found is the DI approach that teaches how to use strategies as well was the best approach to help these kids with learning disabilities learn the target skills. Okay, and so again, a no-brainer, but we need to remind ourselves of this. We can't lose sight of the instruction part of what we're doing. Here we have more evidence that our instruction, not only on the previous slide, it elevates understanding. Here it elevates performance as well, not just understanding. And these are more speech and language associated. DeThorne and colleagues looked at early phono and language skills. Of course, Hudson looks at phonology. Bornstein and colleagues looking at social skills. And really what these researchers find is that systematic instruction not only increases understanding of a skill, but also increases performance, use, production of the skill. And then we know that through inclusion of instruction, these researchers were previously mentioned, that if we have instruction built in, showing that we value the services we're delivering because we're delivering actual teaching, increases those therapeutic alliances. So bottom line here is we have to make sure we teach. We have to, and I know that sounds silly, but we can get pressed for time and move into the session that's just produce, and we have to, and producing lots is great, but we have to make sure that we never have that production demand preceding the teaching of the skills, because we might just have lots of negative practice. Okay, so we have to make sure we leave lots of room in those placeholders in our lesson plan for filling it with instruction. Okay, production practice is that third component in my general plan. My biases related to production practice are on these next couple of slides. You, of course, have to make considerations about training broad versus training deep, and make an intentional selection rather than being sort of haphazard about it. You know, consult your research for the target skills you're working on and know which way you're going. Absolutely, creating the authentic context and then mapping a therapeutic effect onto them. And so lesson plan models can really help you scaffold this part of it. So I'm going to take this authentic context. The kids and I are going to build a volcano together. So we have this authentic context. How am I going to map their production practice onto that? How am I going to obligate productions of those complex sentences or those social moves or the comprehension of concepts? How am I going to map that onto my authentic task? Okay. And then how am I going to set up lots of practice as a built around that authentic context? Okay. And then the distributed versus mass practice is a choice you need to make, similar to making the choice of training broad versus training deep. So if we have an authentic activity, such as the volcano making, we have this authentic context, we're going to map a therapeutic effect onto it. It might mean that we have some distributed practice. We might not get lots of mass practice, but the trade-off might be critical so that they're engaged and they have some self-efficacy and they have some vested interest in the task, okay? But maybe we follow it up with a 3-minute mass practice activity to hit that level of production, okay? So we have to combine these things. It's sort of like choreography with our lesson plan. Other biases I have related to production practice is making sure it's accurate practice versus negative practice, making sure we apply our contingencies, because that's where the use of our contingencies is really how we can infuse more instruction back into our production practice. So if they've missed the mark and their practice was not accurate, we can come in with our contingencies, whether it be a model, a moment of direct instruction, an obligating another production through a visual support, or et cetera. Those contingencies, which really are our feedback, that are specific and supportive of increased successful practice, are really a way to keep our instruction and production practice fluid, moving back and forth. Okay, and all of these things really can move towards those higher and higher levels of successful practice that we need to generalize. Okay, and then we can also, through our production practice, make sure we're making those accommodations for increasing the multiple means of expression or engagement with the client, staying in things that they're interested in, giving them opportunities to express production in different ways. So again, another no-brainer. Clearly, we know there's research out there that supports the fact that that our clients, our students, our learners, practice of the skills promotes use of the skills, okay? And so increased levels of performance definitely will result when you've carefully moved through those components of production practice and made intentional choices. Elliott and Gresham show that through their research related to social skills. Page and Stewart have research in this area related to story grammar, use of story grammar. Faye, Long, and Feinstack have explored increasing levels of performance through production practice with expressive syntax. Jenkins and Bowen have looked at it and shown how it elevates phonological skills by giving clients production practice success. Same with Gildersleeve Newman related to apraxia and increased levels of production practice. So much of our research in our field that's looking at evidence-based practices is really showing that noticeable levels of successful production practice result from clear and associated significant practice. So practice creates accurate production, okay? As long as those components are intentionally selected that we looked at on the previous couple of screens, okay? So that's kind of one of those no-brainers. But more evidence related to production practice that we can sustain and increase learner engagement. So Prince looked at actively engaging university students in learning tasks and found if you keep them active in cooperative learning groups and in problem-based situations for the production practice, their academic achievement goes up. Vaughn, Gersten, and Shard found positive results in academic achievement in the same exact way, but worked with school-age kids with learning disabilities. And then Spooner really looked at implementing elements of universal design for learning to increase practice and production of skills. Okay. Closure is very much like the introduction in terms of the evidence that I have to support it, but a couple of different ways to look at the components of closure. There are three options that I see, and it is really the bookends to the introduction. So reviewing the data or the progress, now let's look back at each story we summarized today and dot, dot, dot. Now each one of you count up your tally marks and we'll talk about how everyone did and what we can work on next time. So that's reviewing the data or the progress. Assigning or encouraging homework. So things like, can you help us think of two times between now and the next time we work together that you could practice what we worked on today? Or here's a storybook to read and practice with a grown-up tonight at home. When you say each of the underlined words, remember our nice hissy s sound at the front. Let's practice that one more time. Okay. And then foreshadowing is the third. So we have reviewing data in progress, assigning homework, and then foreshadowing. So things like, all right, boy, we really got to work out on those pullouts today. Should we plan on working on those again next time, or would you like to try a fluency shaping technique? Or something like, we sure had a blast today while you worked so hard. Next time will be Sarah's turn to choose a book, but Philip will be the recorder, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so you know what those things look like. And like I said, the evidence related to these elements of closure really bookend what we found with introduction. With the exception of the increased generalization of skills, these are researchers Cooper and colleagues and Roberts and Kaiser really looked at homework. And what we know about homework is that if homework is functional, is authentic, and really not just mindless rote things, especially when we're talking about homework related to these authentic speech language communication skills, if our homework is rich and authentic, then it will increase the person's understanding and use of the targeted skills, okay? And so that's really the key to keep in mind with homework. Not rote, contrived practice, but something rich and more authentic related to visuals or media, literacy in particular, literacy and personal experiences. That's what you want your homework to be centered around. Closure can also, as previously discussed with the introduction, sustain or increase the learner engagement and rapport. So really that self-efficacy that we talked about, that this research is all research from the research supporting use of things like the greeting and the warm-up and the introduction. So all of those things that can really build that therapeutic alliance, create that self-efficacy, really make the instruction and therapy collaborative with the client or the caregiver. So if we're working with little ones or people who are significantly cognitively impaired, we might be talking about the caregiver instead of the client. But research shows us that those things can be more, if not as powerful as the instruction and the production practice, okay? People have a vested interest in it. They see the meaningfulness and they're motivated to engage. Okay, so those are that's my general plan, sort of my biases towards making selections for placeholders within that plan, and then the research to support and encourage us to move forward with those choices. just some specifics related to lesson planning. As I stressed several times in the beginning, our written plan versus the mind's eye, that really is going to depend on you, your level of experience, how familiar you are with working with that particular age group or delivery model or targets, skills that are being targeted at. But mental mapping for lesson planning can be terrific. And as long as it's intentional, it can constitute a lesson plan, okay? Just keep in mind, you know, challenging yourself to do a more detailed written plan every once in a while to really be reflective and inform our practice more, but not necessarily on a regular basis, just on an as-needed basis. Don't overcomplicate things either. I do so much of my professional world electronically. The majority of it. I grade papers online, I teach online, I do web conferencing, but I almost always do my lesson plans in written, handwritten form. So I don't know what that says. I know what it says. I have to go through that motion to really do that clinical problem solving piece. And so don't overcomplicate things. Think about mapping out a session versus a week, versus a unit. So there's different things that are best matched to the way in which you're practicing and the setting that you're in. So, you know, you can have a lot of autonomy with those choices. Think about the opportunities that you have to create efficiencies and really document your accountability in your lesson plan. So maybe you're burdened with data collection right now and how to make that happen. My bias related to data collection, and I know this will not fit in everyone's world, but at least stay open to the notion of probes versus being tied to data collection boxes across your entire 20, 30, 60 minute session. There's nothing that says that's the best type of data to take. And actually, I think data taken within the session, within the instruction and production practice tasks is actually fuzzy, messy data. I'm a big fan of probes, maybe during the warm-up or closure or sprinkled somewhere else, of a quickie 10 item or 5 item or 20 item probe of whatever that target skill is that's free from instruction. It's just bang, bang, bang. I've got my data. Now I'm going to set my data aside and I'm going to invest fully in the instruction and the elicitation of practice, having that relationship that's built and rich and responsive. And then have another probe at the end, okay? So think about how your lesson plan can free you up to operate in that way. And remembering, too much detail can make us rigid, so we want to have enough that we can be proactive and not so much that we don't have the flexibility to move within that in ways that are responsive to the learning or the clinical environment, okay? And one of my pet peeves is when lesson plans highlight the materials rather than the techniques or the methods. So the materials are really less important. Now, they can be very important as we're highlighting the fact that we're using authentic materials. But whatever that client or learner is bringing into or has when you enter their environment is authentic. And so we can just be using those things. Sometimes we have to map those out. But we have to be careful that we're not highlighting in our lesson plan contrived materials that really are not the meat of what we're doing. The techniques, the contingencies, the direct instruction, those things are really the meat of our lesson plan. So moving lesson planning into your real world, my call to you now is really to think about either in your mind's eye or in written form, considering a makeover of any dimension of your service delivery that you're just feeling lacks a little luster, or that you maybe set aside components because you felt pressed for time and you felt maybe someone may think of those extras, the warm-up, greetings, homework, discussion, review of data, those sorts of things that maybe you thought should be set aside because you needed to leave more room for instruction and production practice. Now that you have the assurance and evidence of their value, consider adding those back in or including those components. Of course, I would suggest you insist on detailed lesson plans from supervisees. That's just my plea to all of you. Folks who take our students tend to abandon the requirement for those written plans. And this is your opportunity to demand that from someone so that you can really see their clinical problem solving in motion. And so I would encourage you to make that expectation and at least occasional, if not consistently, expect that from supervisees. And then always looking for ways to allow your lesson plans to help you create efficiencies, to elevate your practice, to be highly responsive to stakeholders, to keep yourself organized so that you're not reinventing wheels when you have something you can turn back to that you used before. Absolutely to collaborate with others. That foot in the door into team teaching potentially, or to doing some innovative group models for service delivery, facilitating those collaborations can be pretty cool through lesson planning, and you can connect with those other colleagues in that way. My last message is really just taking glimmers of what I've shared with you today, evidence or my biases, some models that I've shared, and really just implement it in ways that really puts that polish on your practice, takes what you're already doing and spiffs it up a little bit, and allows, more than anything, gives you the reassurance that we have to make sure we don't set aside the art or the science of what we do as speech language pathologists, because both are so highly valued and have such a big part in what we do as we're working on these sensitive roles of human communication and swallowing and cognition and executive functions. We don't want to forget to do the scientific, detailed, systematic teaching with evidence-based practices, and we don't want to forget to do the stylistic, rapport-rich, relationship-building elements either. And so bringing those things together and implementing them with poise and savvy. As I started off saying, we're blessed to be able to do this, but it sure can be darn hard too. So never to underestimate how we're juggling all of those things, and have support behind us to encourage us to practice in that way. So those, and I have lots of resources in the back if you want to look in more detail at any of those evidence-based practice studies. And if I've left a few minutes for questions. I'm shocked, but I did. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Hi, Angie. This is Amy. I'm going to give a couple minutes for people to put in questions if they have them. But in the meantime, I was kind of curious about, I'd be interested in polling the audience, and audience, you can put notes in the Q&A pod. I'm curious about the situations where you work. Is lesson planning required documentation, or is it regulated in any fashion in your school district, in your facility? But I'd kind of like to know how what people encounter in their daily workplace out there. So go ahead and type something in if you have thoughts or want to let us know.
I know I did a quick show of hands in the beginning about those required to submit lesson plans, and it was about a dozen. But I didn't, I didn't ask specifically if it was related to documentation of like progress monitoring versus someone simply wanting to keep track of what. So we have someone saying it's not a requirement where I work. That's one comment we got. Lesson plans have not been required in my workplace. Nothing required. We are very short handed, and as long as we are seeing the students and completing paperwork, we're pretty independent. Lesson planning is required in my district, but not submitted or reviewed. I keep my lesson plans on Google Docs so my supervisor can access them if she wishes, just to keep track of progress. It's not required in my workplace. However, lesson planning drives my documentation. Awesome.
Good for you.
Yeah. not a requirement, but I do it for myself. Excellent. Sarah says, I use them with student interns. Good, good. Please always use them with your students, folks. I'm always surprised how many of my grads out practicing on pre-externships and externships aren't required to write lesson plans. And it's like, oh, they're not ready for that yet. Therapy notes as opposed to lesson plans are required to be turned in. We are told to make them, but not required to turn in lesson plans.
I'm also kind of curious, I'm sorry,
no,
I'm just curious about how many people, I noticed somebody said they were required to keep it in Google Docs, and I know, Andrew, you were talking about how it just sort of helps you to write with an actual pen and piece of paper to think through the clinical problem-solving process, but are there very many people out there who do any of your lesson planning or documentation electronically?
Yeah, show of hands if you're doing lesson planning or documentation in electronic form. If you can do a thumbs up. Yeah. Lots of people. Yeah. More than a dozen have clicked in yes on that. Pen and paper for me, Michelle. I'm.
I agree. There's something about it. It helps me think, but I know I'm.
Well, and I can't reconcile that way. Myself because I'm so tech with everything else. It's just, I get out my old yellow pad and I write lesson plans all the time on it. So I don't know.
I would agree. Well, thank you very much to our audience. I appreciate your participation. And thanks so much, Angie, for a lot of great information on a topic maybe we don't think enough about, but that is such an important part of our practice.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you being able to present to us today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks to everyone.
All right, everybody. We're going to go ahead and wrap up here. I hope everybody has a great day coming up.